Welcome on, bienvenue, and welcome to this episode of United Nations of Horror. It's just two of us today. It's me, Mark, and
Becky.
Right, so we've got a bit of a TV special here. We have decided we're going to come on to United Nations Horror and talk about Twin Peaks. Because I think that qualifies as one of the standout horror TV shows and horror movies, in fact, with me, of the 90s. Would you agree, Becky?
Completely.
Yeah, the elements in it, there's probably nothing more horrific than some elements some scenes, I should say, in the TV series than anything on TV. And that includes, like, the X-Files and stuff like that. There was real dark, dreadful stuff going on. But there's also fun, goofy stuff, too. And we thought we'd come talk about UNH. Because season 3 started next week, so, you know, now's a good time, right? Now, just in case UNH listeners didn't know, Becky and I actually do a kind of mostly weekly, isn't it, show on Twin Peaks called the Twin Peaks Log. We have covered in the last 4 or 5 months every episode of Twin Peaks aired so far, season 1 and season 2. We've covered Firewalk With Me, and we're covering most recently the book written by Jennifer Lynch, David Lynch's daughter, called The Secret Diary of Laura Palmer. And, you know, season 3 is about to start. So if you do dig your Twin Peaks, come and listen to the podcast. We have a good fun time, and we kind of get quite deep into the episodes, right? And sort of go from scene by scene. And we'll be doing the same with season 3. So come listen. If you've never seen the show before and want to catch up, we do not do spoilers ahead. So, for example, if you listen to episode concerning 16 and 17 of the series, we do not spoil anything afterwards. So if you want to watch the series from scratch, you can keep up to date by watching the episode of Twin Peaks and then listening to the podcast. We will not spoil anything for you in the future. So as long as you're keeping pace. Does that make sense? You know, that's worth bearing in mind too. So don't think, oh, if I listen to it, will they spoil something? It doesn't work like that. We specifically done it that way. And we're all kind of excited about season 3, right? So we're kind of all geared up for that. Tonight, we thought we'd kind of give you our general thoughts and some of the characters of the show. So this is probably more for someone who's seen Twin Peaks and is kind of familiar with, but even if you haven't, you might enjoy our sort of rantings stroke musings stroke discussion about what we think of the show. I mean, should we kick it off straight away to say how much we like it? Well, you know, is it in our top 5 and stuff like that, why we like it? Is there anything we don't like about it? So, Becky, let's start with you. Where'd you put this in your... Is this a top 5 ever TV show for you? Top 10? Something like that?
Top three.
Yeah. Go on then. Tell us your other two.
My other two would have to be The Sopranos.
Okay. Yep.
And True Detective.
Now, that's interesting because I haven't seen The Sopranos at all, ever. Right? And I'm halfway through True Detective as we record this. And it's a great show. I'm not arguing there, but I'm looking forward to getting to the end because there's only 8 episodes, right? That's of season 1. There is 2 seasons or 3 now. I'm not sure. Do you know?
There are 2 seasons, but the second one is widely regarded to be awful.
Awful. Okay. All right. Well, I'll concentrate on season 1. Right? It's too much good telly to worry about awful. To be honest, now for me, Twin Peaks is my favourite TV show. I watched it when it was first aired, and I've always loved it. I think in the last year I've watched it through twice. You know, that's how much I like it. I have watched it through maybe 6 times, maybe even 7. I'm not quite sure. Never quite sure how many times I've watched it through, but I enjoy it every single time. There's always new things to find. There's always things you've forgotten and remember. you come to it very recently for this, for the Twin Peaks log, right? That's why you started watching it. I guess prompted by season three, wasn't it? That was. I think I mentioned it to you. Oh man, I really want to do a podcast about Twin Peaks, and you were kind of, oh yeah, I'll have a go.
Prompted by you.
Because we were doing the X-Files. Well, we're still doing the X-Files, but it's kind of taken a bit of a backseat to the Twin Peaks stuff because of the season three impending wondrous stuff, or you know, iceberg that's going to sink everywhere. We don't know yet. That's part of the fun, right? So you've watched it through twice. First time, did it blow your hair back then? I'm going to guess.
Yes. And as we've discussed on the Twin Peaks log, I was going to watch one episode at a time as we recorded, but I just couldn't. I had
I can't blame you. What did you think about watching it for a second time, you know, which we've been doing for the podcast? Did you enjoy it more because you knew what to expect, or wasn't it quite as impactful?
I'd say more, but in a kind of different way. Watching it again, and I know that you've commented before when we've discussed the show that I think watching it in one block, or you know, kind of binge watch, really helps with some of the episodes. I think towards it's in season two that it kind of takes a bit of a dip.
Yeah.
And they're still great episodes. It's just in, you know, comparison to the really great standout ones.
Yeah.
From the series. So watching it together like that allows you to kind of get through those a bit easier, I think, and it creates a better kind of cohesive whole.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people, when they talk about it, they kind of, the common view is, season one's great, season two's terrible, which isn't true at all. And for what happens is season two's pretty damn good up to about episode 17, which I think is episode 9 of season two, where a major, you know, the Laura Palmer stuff kind of gets resolved, and the kind of show meanders around trying to find a new groove for a few episodes, and it finally settles down at about 5 episodes from the end into something great again, right? That's kind of the thing. However, I wouldn't miss a single episode personally. I wouldn't skip any. There's always good stuff. It gets goofy, but there was stuff we really liked in those weaker episodes, which we kind of get into some of those characters, I think. I'll tell you what, let's talk about a few of the characters from this show. I mean, the front and centre is Dale Cooper, right?
Yes.
Solid job here from Carl McLaughlin. It's kind of hard to imagine the show being as good if he wasn't in it, would you say?
Yeah. It'd be hard to imagine Cooper played by anybody else, because the character is so strange and kind of ethereal.
Yeah, he's definitely otherworldly, isn't he? And it's sheer the thing that always gets me is in the pilot is the sheer glee he comes to things with, and enthusiasm. I was thinking about this today. It's kind of interesting because for the rest of the series, he's kind of always interacting with people, so he's bouncing off people. But in that pilot, we see him on his own, you know, talking to Diane about like the trees and the pie. On the way to Twin Peaks, he found a pie shop. He found a shop that sold this great cherry pie and stuff like that. And it's kind of fun to see him all on his own before he starts interacting. But he kind of gels with the community really fast, doesn't he?
Yeah.
He's not an outsider. He's not treated like an outsider. He kind of there. He doesn't show any disrespect to anyone. But they're kind of glad to have him on. Talking of which, is you know, we get to the first contact with Truman. Cooper is Sheriff Truman, right? Harry Truman. Michael Unkin's acting range isn't quite as wide as Carl McLaughlin's, but as Sheriff Truman, he kind of delivers, right?
Yeah, a solid performance, yeah. Definitely.
He's a manly man as well, and it kind of
he is
without being like aggressive. You know,
yes.
He's quiet spoken. He's almost like an old West kind of character, you know, wise, and, you know, he's not going to take any rubbish from anyone, but he's kind of doesn't throw his weight around in any kind of way. Cooper, was there any particular sort of interactions or scenes you particularly like with Cooper?
I think the scene that really stands out to me from the kind of first series is the scene with the donuts when he's talking about Tibet. And that just summarizes his kind of character and his relationship with Twin Peaks and, you know, its inhabitants in a great way without really explaining anything, if that makes sense.
Yeah, he's an intuitive investigator, isn't he? He uses various techniques. And he does actually list, you know, I use this and I use one. There is a scene where he actually lists all these different techniques. And at the end he says, now I have to use something, for want of a better word, we could call it magic. He's trying to conjure up certain elements to sort of reproduce certain things so something happens. I mean, the thing is, the stuff Cooper does in the pilot is probably really stand out because that's the stuff that sets his character and there's the zeitgeist, you know, the stuff about the coffee and the, you know, the donuts and the pie. You know, they got a pie here that's to die for, all that stuff. And this is look too, right? The black suit and the slick back hair is very distinctive. And they were definitely the makers of the X-Files were definitely had a good eye on Twin Peaks before they sort of decided on their own style. I get the feeling. He's a great character, but really, I mean, some of his strengths of interaction with other characters. We'll go through some other characters. We'll kind of bounce that around. So Harry Truman. I mean, the weakest scenes I think with Truman is he has to do some drunk acting. Actually, we should say we're going to have spoilers in this episode, right? So we're going to talk about this, that, and the other, everything in season one and two, and probably Firewalk with Me. Maybe we might even talk about that. So just be aware of that before you continue listening. So some of the drunk acting from Michael Unkin when Josie dies isn't great, but you know, it was fine. It was fine, and he's good fun. I've got a lot of characters here, and there was a lot of interesting little side characters that popped up here and there. So I'll mention those if it feels appropriate. Otherwise, I'm going to kind of stick to the main characters, I think. The town is kind of divided into families, kind of. And there's a few like lone individuals. So what I'll do is kind of talk about some of the family groupings and the associated people around there. So let's talk about the Horns, right? The Horns, who have this business empire in this little town. Now, just at the beginning of Twin Peaks, it always says 51,000, doesn't it, in Twin Peaks? But actually, that's a typo. Did you know that?
No.
That's a mistake that they never corrected. Someone's thought it was a laugh just to leave it there. Apparently the town is 5,000, not 51,000. So bearing that in mind, the Horns run a massive hotel, like a leisure hotel, a department store, and also the town has its own bank, right, and savings place. I'm trying to think, wow, it's got its own airport as well, right?
Yes, it does.
It's got a lot of this town. This town was obviously a prosperous place, obviously from timber, right, initially. There is that. So the patriarch of the family is Ben Horn, played by Richard Boehmer from, probably most famous after this as being, I think, Tony in West Side Story?
Yeah.
Which was a number of years before this. What do you think of his performance?
Fantastic.
He goes from I keep describing him in the Twin Peaks log as like being like the big bad wolf, who kind of got that leery, grinning, cheeky sort of it's dastardly. I mean, he's not evil, he's dastardly. I think it's a great description of him. And he's chomping a cigar for most of season one and season two, but he tries to reform himself and he's chomping carrots for the rest of the show, right? He's always got to be chewing on something. And he's got a real relish about the deal, isn't he? He loves business. Even when it doesn't work, he kind of loves it, right? So he's a lot of fun. And we get, in very few episodes, we get his wife, Sylvia. I think she turned up in 4 episodes, which I was surprised. I thought it was like 2.
Me too, yeah.
But she does turn up here in it. And apparently she's in season 3. So how about that? So, but she's not much of a character, right? After that, I think the most obvious one is Audrey. Sherilyn Fenn, Audrey Horne. Wow, she's really something in this, right?
Yes. We've spoken before on the Twin Peaks saga about how she's a kind of central character that is very much, in some ways, a complete inversion of Laura Palmer. So she's a really interesting one in terms of her dynamics with other characters, including her father, and how these other characters relate to Laura during that initial kind of investigation. And then she kind of gets her own complete trajectory, doesn't she, when the Laura Palmer arc is finished, which was I thought was pretty interesting.
Yeah, I mean, even during the Laura Palmer one, she goes off to try and investigate to help Cooper because she's romantically attracted to Cooper, right? So she wants to show him that she's capable, so she does her own little investigation, but comes a cropper quite badly, right? But she has her own little love story. She's kind of sweet. I kind of like that. A lot of people crap on that one with John Wheeler or Jack Wheeler. Billy Zane play. But I kind of like it. It is kind of cheesy, but I like it. What do you think of that?
I love that. It was a real kind of sweet moment, especially during the darker aspects of the series, and it really tied into the melodrama that we were missing because we had lost Invitation to Love by that point, the kind of soap within the series.
Let's talk about Invitation to Love while we're at it, actually. Yeah, it was a shame when that went out, and it was almost like they took elements of that show, right? So let's just say Invitation to Love, it's basically a soap within a soap, right? It's a soap opera that the inhabitants of Twin Peaks watches. A cheesy, proper American daytime soap opera, but it's kind of commenting on what's happening in Twin Peaks, isn't it? That's kind of how it worked. But they removed that element, didn't they, at some point in season two. Someone didn't like it, I guess, or they just couldn't be bothered. But what happened was we found that traditional soap opera stuff then got incorporated into Twin Peaks instead. Like you say, and now the one of those was Sherilyn Fenn and John Wheeler, right? Yeah, a lot of people have trouble with Billy Zane, but I really like him actually. He's got a kind of weird, slightly can't trust this guy air about him, hasn't he? I guess.
Yeah, but he's got just enough kind of acting chops to pull that off.
I have to confess, one of my favourite films of a terrible kind is he made this film with Kelly Brook. Oh, yes. An island called
Three.
I really love that because he plays the enraged husband.
Because you didn't love it because it's where she gets all the kit off.
Well, that helps. That helps. But I just like films where I hate to confess this, but I've got a mini subgenre where a husband gets wronged by a wife who goes off with a horrible French lover, and then the husband kills them. And Three is that subgenre, and Richard Gere made one with Diane Lane, and I can't remember what it's called now.
Unfaithful.
And I just
I know this genre.
Yeah. I just like the fact that weedy little annoying French dudes get their heads beaten in by enraged husbands. I just love that. It's my favourite weird subgenre. Billy Zane's great in it because he goes properly tonto in Three, doesn't he? He goes properly mad, like turns into Rambo almost in this. You're not a fan, obviously.
No, we're gonna have to do an episode on this subgenre, I think.
That's the only two films I know. Anyway, all right, okay. I think we've gone off on that's me. I've dragged this off on a tangent. Yeah, so Audrey Horne, I mean, Sherilyn Fenn's got a very distinctive classical look, hasn't she? She's almost painfully beautiful in some of the shots in here when she's dressed in a certain way, isn't she? Well, I think she is anyway.
There's
something almost like Elizabeth Taylor about her to me, young Elizabeth Taylor.
Very kind of 50s style, very Marilyn Monroe. And we've talked before about how Mark Frost and David Lynch were originally hoping to work on a project together about Marilyn.
And I
think they've kind of channeled that into some of the shots of Laura Palmer, and especially with Audrey's character. Yeah,
there's definitely, I mean, the whole show's got a definite 50s stroke hard to pin down an era vibe about it, isn't it? There's definitely 50s elements in the music and the look, and Audrey is really significantly like that. She's very, I think we've, in the Twin Peaks logs, we said that there's something Douglas Sirk about a lot of Twin Peaks, and Audrey is front and center in that as well, as well as like Bobby Briggs and James Hurley. Those types are definitely like that. Okay, carry on from the Horn family. We have Johnny Horn, who's like the boy who is, he's got some sort of learning difficulties, isn't he? He doesn't, he's got a, like a mental age of a child. He dresses up as a Native American chief and fires rubber arrows around. Interesting, I didn't realise he was played by two different actors. I think in the pilot it was one actor and they got a different actor in for the rest, but it's, you kind of see him from the side and fleetingly. He's never like has a scene with anyone, does he? He's just in a scene
with, yeah, people.
So he's part of the family too. And the other big one in the old Horn family is Ben's brother Jerry, Ben and Jerry, Jerry Horn. David Patrick Kelly. I really enjoy some of the scenes between Ben and Jerry, especially when they're musing over business stuff, and Ben's trying to think through the deal while Jerry's going on about food or women is the other one, particularly Icelandic goddesses and things like that that he's met. They just make me laugh. Any thoughts on Jerry?
Jerry really kind of shines, I think, in scenes particularly with Ben, and there's one scene in particular where they kind of reminisce about their childhood and where everything kind of went wrong, you know, what got them to that point in the series, and it's a really touching scene, and we get a little flashback to when they were kids.
Yeah, we do, and it's really sweet, and this older girl, I think, who's babysitting them is kind of dancing for them in a fairly innocent way, and it's a really sweet scene. It really, yeah, works well. And I think it might actually relate back to the very first scene we see with Jerry, where he comes in with a massive brie sandwich and they're stuffing their faces and they're saying, oh, do you remember Ginny down by the river? And I think that's a reference. That is something they're talking about that's connected to that scene. But I could be wrong. I'd have to watch it all. I'd have to watch all 30 episodes again to be sure. but there's some great scenes between these two. They're like, there's a scene that always makes me laugh where Leland's kind of, it's when Leland's hair's gone white, but he's feeling much better again. And he's dancing around and he comes into their office and starts like singing a song. And they both just start dancing on the desk. Ben's on the desk and Jerry's dancing around, and it just makes me laugh so much. And when they're stuffing their faces, and there's also another scene where they're like thinking about what to do with the ledgers of the meal, whether to burn the real ledger or the fake ledger. But in the meantime, Jerry's got a pig made of cheese and he doesn't know what to do with it, and he's wondering about it. Well, Ben's going, oh, should we do this or should we do this? And he just says, all I know is I want to eat this pig. And stuff like that. Yeah, that was fun. I just want to go back to Sherilyn Fenn. She's got some other great scenes. I do remember the scene where she actually gets into One Eyed Jacks and auditions with Blackie. That was kind of an interesting scene. It's, she famously ties a cherry stem in a knot with her tongue, which everyone started trying to do, I remember. I was getting cherry stems and practicing tying them, and I couldn't do it, I don't know. But yeah, trust me, take my word for it, there were people trying to practice in that after she pulled that stunt. I don't know if it's possible though, personally. Okay, let's move on to the next kind of major sort of family, the Haywoods. So let's start with Dr. Haywood. A lot of episodes, wasn't he, this fella?
He was indeed.
And possibly one of the better actors in a role that didn't demand, I don't know how to put this, he's a very solid presence in the show, right? A very stabilising presence, I thought.
He really is, and he's kind of, and again, I don't want to kind of say this in the wrong way, but he's more of a supporting character in a lot of scenes. So he isn't the, you know, like no. Some of the other performances are more kind of batshit crazy or, no. You know, more pronounced. He's always, like you say, a very stable performer, but he's solid all the way through. And he's really likable, and he's I must say he's one of my favourite characters in the series.
Yeah, I think if I'm going to go into, I think it's, I've recently read The Secret Diary of Laura Palmer, and Laura has a phrase about Dr. Haywood. She said he feels like has the kindness of a grandfather, but with a father's hand. That's how she kind of puts it. You know, he combines those roles into one person. Laura Palmer really loves Dr. Haywood. And I think, you know, he feels that way about her too. He feels like the only person in Laura's world, the little we know about Laura, that actually is all just there for her. I think there's only a few characters that Laura feels completely happy with. Johnny Horn's one of them, and Dr. Haywood's another. Everyone else has doubts and stuff around them, but not those two. He's good. There is a funny art thing, though. If you watch Doc Haywood, whatever he's in, he seems to do everything in this town. He's there wherever you need some sort of medical or test or something like that. Doc Haywood's in everything. So it's kind of comedy that a doctor does all this, but it kind of works because you know the character, right? You know what he's there for and stuff like that. He has some great little lines as well, doesn't he? He's like, there's one line where they find out Leland's killed Jacques Renault, and Cooper's kind of questioning him, and as they leave, Dr. Haywood says, Cooper saying he's got to face the full force of the law, and Haywood's kind of suggesting, you know, we should have some sympathy for him because he's lost his daughter. And Cooper's like, you saying the law should be subverted or something like that, you know. And it was a really nice little scene between the two of them. I thought really effective. We got to mention he's Mark Frost's father, right? And Mark Frost, one of the main sort of constructors of Twin Peaks. In fact, you know, is this the time now to talk about David Lynch a bit? What do you reckon?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, the show is mostly referred to as David Lynch's show, isn't it? But that's not quite true, is it? I mean,
no.
Mark Frost is as important in his own way. What David Lynch brings is that style, that look, that oddness that really makes the show stand out. I kind of agree with that. But I think Mark Frost just tempers that so well and grounds it and makes it not completely either too weird or too pretentious for a mainstream audience. And I think that's really important. And as I say, Doc Haywood's his dad. and I have to also mention Mark Frost has recently written The Secret History of Twin Peaks, which is a really interesting read. I think it's got clues in it for season 3, but you and I might be getting to talk about that on the Twin Peaks log real soon, right?
Yeah.
So there is that to mention. Again, back to the Haywoods. I'm going to leave Donna till the end because I want to talk about Donna and other people as well. So the next one is the wife, Eileen Haywood, who's Mary Jo Dachanel. She's okay. Not great, but okay. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, she hasn't given very much to do with majority of, you know, her time on screen. And we get some kind of drama from her towards the end, I think, you know, she was perfectly decent in.
Yeah, and I have to say that drama with her is also one of Doc Haywood's more emotionally charged scenes, isn't it? Where he's dealing with Ben Horn. So interesting scene all around. She's all right. She's Zoe Dachanel's mother. Actually, the actress playing this, so that's kind of interesting.
And Emily.
And what? Emily Dachanel, yeah. Okay. there's also a couple of other daughters of the family. We'll get onto Donna in a minute, but we see the other daughters briefly here and there through the series, but mostly they disappear. Virtually every dinner scene, it's just Donna and her parents. When it comes to it. I don't know. There was Gersten Haywood, who was played by Alicia Witt, who we see doing some pretty cool stuff with the piano. And one scene where Leland's kind of feels he's over a hump about what happened to Laura. And then there was another one called Harriet, who I think we've seen the pilot and maybe one other time. who's kind of covering for Donna when she wants to sneak out. But we don't see him the rest of the time, do we? So there's not much to say. So that brings us to Donna. Donna. What do you think of Donna?
Donna, she is the kind of crux of the melodrama of the show, isn't she?
A lot of crying.
Yeah.
She's a beautiful crier. In that she kind of... so I have to say, sometimes I'm kind of laughing. However, I think she's kind of cool. I like it. Yeah, it does verge, like you say, she brings the melodrama, doesn't she? So she brings up the invitation to love element in a bit. And of course, there is this major thing with her and James that's the Circean or kind of rebel without a cause kind of love thing, right? The room.
Yeah.
There's a touch of that. So we get Donna and Jane. Donna has an interesting arc because she's fairly sort of open-eyed and kind of innocent and clearly a friend of Laura, but she feels kind of guilty because she falls in love with James, who James was in love with Laura, but it turns out that maybe he was in love with Donna. So there's kind of that sort of triangle, isn't there, between like the dead Laura and Donna and James. And injecting herself in that is cousin Maddie, who's Cheryl Lee playing the cousin of Laura Palmer. I'm glad she got in this, and we saw some of her acting in this. It was a pretty cool idea, actually. What do you think of this kind of love triangle between the three of them? Or, you know, it wasn't quite, I don't know, there was a bit of kissing and stuff between Maddie and James, but really it was Donna and James, really, wasn't it, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, I think it was a real nice touch to bring, you know, the actress back in terms of, you know, more of a role because Laura Palmer, obviously, it would have only been a limited kind of run on the show. So I think it was a really nice way to use her and to utilise her in that way with the triangle. But it's more, like you say, about James and Donna. But these are the really kind of... sickly sweet moments, aren't they?
Yeah. There's that scene they do with the song. Though I understand, I think Mike Tunstroker told me one time that scene with the song, you know, just you and I, all that, where Maddie and Donna are singing in the background, Lynch views that as like the key scene of Twin Peaks. And I have a bit of trouble with that because I can't quite see why it would be, other than it is embodying innocence and jealousy and, you know, making up and corrupted love, which I think is, you know, all in those scenes, that one scene, right? So maybe it's that, but I still don't quite see it myself. But it's an interesting one. I mean, you and I make endless fun at James, don't we?
Yes.
I tried to be nice, but I just couldn't bring myself to do it. All right, okay. With all this mix, I'm aware we're going to be talking about, we are requested feedback on the United Nations already, anyway, so we're going to be getting there. There's one character that does come up in the feedback, and we'll talk about the feedback when we do the feedback. but Harold Smith, Donna starts doing Laura's Meals on Wheels to investigate stuff, right? To try and get to the mystery of Donna, because... you know, while Aldred's going off and doing her stuff, Donna, Maddie and James decide they're going to investigate too, right? They think there's shenanigans going on. So Donna volunteers to do the Meals on Wheels, and she encounters Harold Smith, who's this shut-in guy, isn't he? Formed a fairly distinct relationship with Laura. Now, I have to say, for some points, I actually did think Harold was the murderer. First time I saw this, so I was thinking there's something not right about this guy, other and above, you know his psychological problems, agoraphobia. What do you think of him?
Yeah, I did have my suspicions as well because of his strange behaviour. And I love the kind of, we've spoken about this, is his character is quite voyeuristic and in some ways kind of omniscient in the way that he knows things and he gets people to bring their stories to him because he can't leave the house. And I really enjoyed that, but nothing was kind of done with that aspect. And he played it in a very, not just melodramatic, but quite hammy, quite one note way.
Yeah, so he didn't think it was much of a performance.
No, but I mean, it worked on some levels because, yeah, it was creepy and, you know, you were second guessing him. But I think a little bit more, I don't know, it could have been a little bit more sinister, something a little bit just to take it up a notch, I think, that performance.
Yeah, it was. I mean, he goes full hysterical at one point, doesn't he, where he scratches his face.
But that, again, it just felt very, I don't know, kind of still quite flat, and it didn't kind of match the other kind of melodrama in the series for me.
Yeah. Okay, I kind of like Harold. I don't mind Harold, but I can absolutely see why anyone would have a problem, because he's got that kind of, he is very one note, right? I think if he was in only in four episodes in the end, and I think if it had gone on, it would have got tiresome. It was getting old fast, wasn't it? So I kind of see that. Okay, let's move on. The next kind of set are the people sort of gravitating around the double R somewhat. So that would start. Let's start with Norma. We get Norma here, and the central relationship here is Norma and Big Ed. Really, personally, one of my favourite relationships in the show, because it was like the way a good soap opera would do something like this. What do you feel about it?
Yeah, definitely. And I think along with Dr. Hayward, they are the most realistic characters, I think, the kind of madness of Twin Peaks.
Go on.
Just to say that their relationship felt very real and truthful.
Yeah, and they both had horrible choices for marriage, right? It would appear, certainly something that didn't say. Norma's kind of stuck with Hank, who's like a bad'un through and through. And Ed's got Nadine, who isn't a bad'un. She's just not who he wants to be with. And it's kind of a shame, isn't it? I mean, she's a bit crazy, but she's not a bad one. I have to say, one of the things I really like about Norma and Big Ed is it's about as close, I feel, as American cinema, or TV, ever got to something like Brief Encounter.
Yes.
There's a definite vibe there to me. You know, they both want each other, but know that they've got duties and responsibilities. And they don't, basically, it's more, actually, it's not just that, they don't want to hurt other people, right?
Yeah.
And it's kind of a shame, really. Hank, yeah, what do you think of this, his acting here? Is Chris Mulkey's the actor?
Great. You know, I think Hank, because of his relationship with so many of the characters, from being a kind of, what is he, a hitman, a criminal for hire kind of thing?
Yeah, and he seems to be working with everyone, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Whoever pays him, he'll work for, or what with. He's working, let's count the ways, right? He's working with Leo, Jacques Renault at one point. Ben and Jerry Hall, Josie, there's a big thing between him and Josie. I think there's a few others.
Ernie. Norma's mum's.
Ernie.
Bloke.
So he's got his fingers in loads of pies. I thought he was all right. I think the scenes that didn't work with me for this actor was where he was kind of trying to flirt or, you know, make up with Norma, and Norma was buying it. I didn't quite buy that she was buying it, if you know what I mean. I know that was the script and that, but I just didn't think he was quite charming enough in those scenes for me to think, oh yeah, I can see why Norma would, you know, soften when he says stuff like that. But, you know, that's the script, right? So can't entirely blame the actor for that. So the other side of this equation is probably Nadine, right? So we kind of talked about she's nuts. So she's got an obsession with red drapes, and then she gets an obsession with Mike and wrestling. What do you think of this arc?
I didn't like the wrestling one too much.
Not a fan of that, right?
No. I mean, the way she kind of lost her memory was fine and everything.
Yeah.
But I just thought that was really not needed.
I have to say, I love the wrestling stuff. It just makes me
really
laugh. Yeah, I think it's super funny. I really particularly like, there's a point where she's sharing slides of her wrestling stuff to people, and it just makes me laugh because she's so gleeful about it. And it's all the super strength stuff, properly goofy, and sometimes not very well shot. It's like, she wouldn't just go over and throw a guy, which she does at one scene. But, you know, it's kind of, it does make me laugh. It does make me laugh. I want to touch on a couple of very small bit plot players circling the double R. We get a chap who turns up now and again called Toad, who's constantly eating his breakfast and getting interrupted. I think at one point he's eating his breakfast and Norma's mum goes and dips something in his egg to try it, or cuts a bit off his egg, and he's eating his breakfast, and she just walks up and they're always like hustling Toad out the main area if they've got someone important coming, and this poor guy, all he's doing is eating his breakfast. He makes me laugh, but you know, he's got no character as such. And the other one that I thought was interesting is Heidi, who only ever appears in the pilot and the finale. She's like this giggle. I think she's like Swedish or something. She's got a strong accent, and she giggles, and they make a joke about her. Oh, what were you? Do you have trouble jump starting the old man this morning? And they did that almost exactly word for word in the pilot and the finale. Which, if you go back and listen to our show about Firewalk with Me, we talked to Mike from Chitroker versus Partner. He says it makes the show feel very circular, having so many references between the first, you know, the pilot and the finale. And Heidi is one of those circular references, right? So, and it's interesting they got the just for those two scenes, really. It's kind of funny. She does appear briefly in Firewalk With Me as well, actually, with a bleeding nose, which is odd. Oh, and finally, I guess, for the double R, Annie. We get Heather Graham as Annie, who doesn't appear until the last, I think, six episodes. Cooper instantly kind of falls in love with her, doesn't he? What do you think of Annie?
I really liked Annie as a character. She is a great kind of complementary character to Cooper, because they're both quite childlike in the way I think they see the world. They find a kind of beauty in it that, you know, others may not. And she's obviously troubled. We know that she's tried to take her own life, and we don't really get much of the kind of backstory, but you know, she kind of took herself away from everything and has only recently come back. And I really liked their little relationship. It was really heartwarming, and the scenes they had in the diner together.
Yeah, I think it works well. It's convincing, isn't it? That's convincing. They're very complementary characters, and they're very open. They've got they're childlike in their openness, and they're childlike in their confidence, right? They kind of come across as confident, even when they're saying, oh, I don't know what to do. They're very confident, you know. There's a scene where Cooper goes in to see him, and he says, when I see you, I get like butterflies in my tummy. And he's saying it with a big grin on his face, like completely unself-consciously.
Yes.
And it's really wonderful. It's really wonderful, some of that stuff. So I'm a fan of Annie too. And it kind of makes sense to me. I would have liked to have known a little more about, you know, what other problems were. But it kind of worked for me. I could kind of see why Cooper would have fallen in love with her. It did make sense. So that was cool. Let's mention briefly also, I think we kind of touched on this. We got Norma's mum turns up. And she's a kind of a bit of a witch to Norma, isn't she? She's not very nice, very dismissive of Norma and what she does. And it turns out, and this has got one of the weakest plots elements in it, she's actually a food critic in Decide called M.T. Wentz, and there's like whole scenes of like people wondering who M.T. Wentz is, who this mystery food critic is who's going to write this review. And it turns out it's Norma's mum, and she writes Norma a terrible review, which isn't very nice, is it? And doesn't Norma just say, get out of my cafe and get out of my life at one point? What do you think of that? Our role, that character.
Interesting, because she's so like Norma. She's so kind of composed, and you know, she seems to be quite cold and detached, which isn't kind of like Norma. It isn't. I wouldn't have imagined her mother to kind of be that way. So it was an interesting turn of events, and it was a really strange little kind of narrative aside, wasn't it? Because it was just kind of dropped as a plot. Kind of subplot for several episodes.
It was just dropped. And then came back just right before she disappeared, and then we never heard from it again, so it was kind of pointless. The good thing out of it was her husband, her new husband. I kind of like Ernie Niles as a character. He's kind of a fun... he's played by James Booth, who's a good English actor. He's probably most famous for playing... I've forgotten his name. Hook in Zulu. The Michael Caine from Zulu, he does a great job in that, and he's pretty good as Ernie Niles, and he's got that kind of Damon Runyon, you know, low life criminal vibe about him, hasn't he? He's always making excuses and trying to wheel and deal, but he's not very good at it. He's a bit of a con man, you know. He says, "Oh, I don't gamble anymore," and he's carrying around like a racing newspaper with like bets written on and stuff like that. But I kind of liked him. He wasn't much of a character. There's some interesting stuff where they have to get him involved to do catch Jack Renault. I kind of like. Jean Renault. I like. That was kind of cool. That brings us to one of the other major families, and probably the most significant one we're going to talk about in terms of Laura Palmer and the Palmers. So we've got Ray Wise as Leland Palmer and Grace Zabriskie as Sarah Palmer, both of which are signed up for season 3, which is interesting because Leland Palmer died. to be honest, UNH listeners should really go listen to our show to know how exactly we feel about Ray Wise. We kind of love him, right? We think he does a great job in this.
Oh, fantastic. One of the standout performances of the series.
Yeah.
If not the, really.
Yeah, it's a great performance. And he does a great performance in Far Walk With Me as well, as does Cheryl Lee. I mean, Cheryl Lee doesn't get that much to do. She gets some as Maddie, but in terms of her, you know, some great acting, she does a great performance if I want to. But back to Ray Wise, a really fantastic job. He's got that iconic look, hasn't he, Ray Wise?
Yes.
And that energy. Some of my favourite episodes are where he goes full, like, almost Joker, where we know he's Bob. But the authorities haven't caught on. He's murdered Maddie, and he's still on the loose for a couple of episodes, right, before they catch him. Fantastic. He keeps transitioning. He's, you know, we can see that Bob's fully in control, and we can see that sort of Leland's trying to pretend. There's a scene that's amazing where they have to give Leland some news that I think it was Jacques Renault wasn't the killer of Laura, and he has to, and he goes off in a corner, and he almost looks like he's crying. But when it pans around and we see his face, he's trying to stifle laughing, isn't he? And Cooper's looking at him like he thinks there's something odd, but he can't quite put his finger on it. But in effect, he looks like he's crying. Fantastic. And Grace Zabriskie, I mean, it's a fairly hysterical performance, isn't it? But it's intended to be. I mean, this is a woman on the edge. And, you know, we find out in the show that she's been drugged, and I think, there were some really good scenes. I think the whole Laura Palmer funeral was kind of amazing, but funny, but awful, but it had so many emotions to take. You know, Leland jumping on the coffin and Grace Zabriskie saying, "You do want to spoil this too?" Which has got a dark undertone to it, hasn't it? And I have a feeling Sarah Palmer's going to be kind of key to season three, but we'll get into that more when we talk about season three in some episode, probably on the Twin Peaks log, right?
I think so. And also just to say that her performance is very kind of nuanced, and the more you kind of get into the series, and Fire Walk With Me, The Secret Diary of Laura Palmer, the book, that all really kind of informs her performance, I think. And when you come back to the series with that knowledge, you realize just how much she's kind of nailed it. And coming back to series three, her kind of psychic ability is something that's really intrigues me in terms of how that's going to develop in terms of the plot.
It's her psychic ability that makes me think she'll be somehow central to season three, actually. We can't really say enough good things about Ray Wise. We think he's terrific. Who was your favorite? Let's just have diverge a bit. Say, who was your top three actors in this? All of this?
In terms of acting, top three, sheer acting. Like acting performances. Yeah. Ray Wise.
Yeah.
Would have to be up there. I think Cooper.
Yeah.
And it was really hard to pick a third one. But I'm going to have to go with Sarah Palmer.
Right, that's a good choice. Good set of choices. Wouldn't argue with that. My list of those three would probably be Ray Wise again. I really like Richard Boehmer as Ben Horn. I know it was broad, but I just thought... But there was dark bits, right? And there was bits where he was really down to heel, and he was like, and he was the bits where he's going mad and all this that. But I just thought it was really good. And the other one I really liked was Bobby. Now, it's interesting, Bobby Briggs. I don't think we covered yet. No, we haven't got it yet. I just want to diverge onto him. He's, I think, in the first few episodes, he's very stylized acting. And it feels a bit false because of that, but I think he's been directed that way. But actually, as the show goes on, he kind of just gets better and better. And until we get to Fire Walk With Me, where he gives a great performance, I thought. But there are some really outstanding performances throughout this show. The thing is, some of the... You know, if you talk about great acting performances, that would give you one list. But if you say favourite characters... And the favorite stuff coming out of people's mouths, you're going to pick an entirely different list, perhaps, aren't you? Because there's some great characters in this. They're not necessarily great acting performances, but they're great characters acted well, and appropriately. But because there wasn't, that character wasn't engaged in such an emotional journey. Say, we're not going to see so much of a performance out of them, are we? Okay, so the next house I wanted to talk about is the Martells. So we got Jack Nance as Pete Martell and Piper Laurie as Catherine Martell. In fact, she played two roles, didn't she, Piper Laurie?
Kinda. She did indeed.
At one point, she was a Japanese businessman. Tajimura. So Jack Nance, kind of awesome. As Pete, I think. He was a jack of all trades. Catherine was really horrible to Pete, wasn't she? For lots of it. Though she kind of softened a bit here and there. There was this general contempt for Pete, wasn't there? And he was like this working... He was like a blue-collar guy. And he got married to Catherine, who was like the princess of the house, I think, when they got married. And she just never treated him with anything other than contempt at some point. And it never changed, right? But Pete was happy to be with her, it felt like. What do you think?
Yeah, and there are moments, like you say, where it shines through that she does need him, if not care explicitly, but she does seem to have some feelings towards him. But I must say, Catherine's character is, I love the fact that she is a cold-hearted businesswoman who does, whatever she wants to kind of, make things happen. And that was a really nice kind of portrayal, I think.
Yeah, it's I like the fact she also has this relationship with Ben Horn, who's a similar vibe, you know, a businessman, a cold-hearted businessman who loves the deal and knows how to get it, and they're kind of sexually attracted to each other. They're a couple of alley cats around each other, really, is how it is. It's kind of funny. And you kind of get the idea Pete knows about it but doesn't care, or, you know, doesn't want to say anything through some of this as well. There's one point where he goes and visits Ben in a cell and plays a tape from Catherine and is like laughing at Ben, where he must be not complicit, but he must be aware of what's, you know, their relationship, their sexual relationship, or, you know, whatever. You know, I think he's so attached to Catherine, he just doesn't say anything about it. Also in that household, we get Josie Packard, Joan Chen. What do you think of her performance?
Interesting character, but in terms of the performance, yeah, Josie's a strange, like, I think it relates back to the character and the fact that we've talked about her, she's a bit problematic in some respects, because for starters, she's not meant to have a great grasp of the English language, but she kind of does.
She's supposed to be kind of manipulative, but I always feel like she's way over her head. I never get that conveyed from either the acting performance or the writing that she is fairly adept at manipulating people. She always feels like, oh, you know, I've been caught out again or something. So that element of the character, she's supposed to be like this, like, you know, clever, manipulative woman, but it doesn't kind of come across. But having said that, I kind of like Josie as a character. It kind of works for me. But more as a how she's interacts with others, I kind of like the stuff with her and Harry.
Yeah.
But there's some very odd stuff goes on. There's one, basically her character gets treated as like a slave for a section of the series, right? And it just doesn't feel real. And Pete kind of is complicit. And one of the things is, Pete and Josie are like supposed to be super good friends, which annoys Catherine, you know, because Pete's very kind to her. But there's one point he's kind of complicit in treating her like a skivvy. And he does kind of justify by saying, oh, all right, can we stop this little joke now at one point or something like that? But it seems a bit odd, doesn't it? Doesn't feel right for Pete anyway.
That's it. And with the, you know, like I say, with the kind of language thing, the writing doesn't quite inform the character. So it doesn't feel, straight away, she feels a bit off kilter. Like she doesn't kind of fit in with the rest of, you know, Twin Peaks and such. So it was, she's a bit of a strange one. And again, the kind of way she vacates the series was just a bit baffling, wasn't it?
Drawn up. The other one, I mean, I haven't got much to say about this, but it's Andrew Packard too. Turns up, it's supposed to be dead, isn't he? Josie's supposed to have killed him as well. He turns up as well. It was all right, but it didn't really add much, I don't think. I think the character was a little underwritten. It's kind of felt very stock soap opera character, you know, bad guy number three. And, you know, business dealer number three kind of thing. And having said that, another character who kind of turns up and feels a bit stock is the man from Hong Kong. He's supposed to be Josie's cousin stroke servant. You know, he's all right and he kind of adds to it. But, you know, one thing I will say about Josie is she shot Cooper, right?
She did indeed.
Because he's nosing around, I think, is the explanation. Or something like that. It's like, because it's her, right? That was it. And also tied in that, we get David Warner, great actor, turns up for a few episodes as Thomas Eckhart. Doesn't have much to do other than looking fires, wearing Ray-Bans and look cool, right? That's kind of what he does in most of his scenes. What do you think of Eckhart?
Again, he's a bit kind of Bond villainy.
I really liked his assistant, Jonesy.
Yes.
She was kind of cool.
And again, that she reminded me of kind of, you know, a James Bond kind of, you know, the top villain's right hand, usually man, but in the way that she tried to kill Truman. In the most bizarre way possible. Yeah.
With a James Bond type device, you know, garrotting thing in her watch, I think, wasn't it? After sex, we think we wasn't quite sure.
Well, after splashing in with Josie's perfume, I thought was poisoned.
We couldn't work it out. And there's also, she delivers a package to Packard as well, doesn't she? Andrew Packard as well, and they can't open it, and there's a whole set of scenes of them trying to open this mystery box. Okay, right, let's get to the sheriff's station, right? We've obviously talked about Truman, but we got Lucy. Well, we got Hawk. Hawk's a fairly solid character, but doesn't really have that much to do. There's some comedy stuff about him trying to use his like Native American wisdom to try and impress Lana. Oh, and we'll talk about Lana in a bit. That made me laugh. But Hawk's decent, but he hasn't got much in terms of like personal drama, has he?
No, but he's a solid character, and yeah. I really like his relationship with the, you know, with like Truman and Cooper and even Ande.
Yeah, I do like his relationship with the rest of the guys. I think they're very solid. It's a very solid crew. And then also that brings us to Lucy and Andy. So love Lucy. Lucy makes me laugh. I'll tell you what, I love it when Lucy gets cross about something and she does the rising voice thing, you know. Why don't you get out of here? And Andy, I felt a bit bad for Andy sometimes, because sometimes they present him as a bit of a Forrest Gump type, don't they? It feels a bit...
But he's a lovable Forrest Gump.
He is lovable. He's always got some news to tell someone, and he gets kind of excited about things sometimes. And that scene where he bashes his head in and starts walking around in a weird way, like his legs are giving out under him, just makes me laugh so much. Especially when he does it in front of Albert. It's like, oh, another great moment in law enforcement. they have this sweet, sweet sort of relationship. She's peeved at him for like the whole of season one, right?
Yeah.
Pretty much. And it turns out she's pregnant. Which brings me to the next character. Do you know what I'm going to say, Becky?
Oh, yes, I do.
It's Dick, isn't it? Dick by
my favourite.
Dick Tremaine, the louche, you know, lounge lizardy type who works at the men's counter in Horn's department store. He's very well dressed. He's extremely shallow. I mean, he's shallow as a puddle on a hot day, isn't he? He really is. But Lucy had like a one night stand with him, and now so he could be the father, Andy could be the father. Lucy can't work it out, and there's all that. But bizarrely, because they're trying to kind of show, Dick has like this thing where he says, "I could be a good father. I'm going to show you." And both him and Andy get into this kind of competitive frame of mind where they're trying to show Lucy they both could both be good parents. But it turns out they kind of form a little duo of and go off and leave Lucy alone. And we refer to it as the Dick and Andy show, don't we? In the Twin Peaks line. I really love these two when I'm doing stuff. They have to look after this orphan called Little Nicky, who they eventually suspect is the devil. So they're investigating that. I could have watched a whole series on that arc alone, I gotta say. What's your thoughts on it?
Oh, I adore the Dick and Andy show, and you know, all of the scenes with Little Nicky. And it was interesting on the Twin Peaks log when we had Mike on from Chinstroker versus Punter, and he seemed like the lowest point of the series for him was when Andy had a little kind of cartoon kind of bubble.
Yeah.
And we saw, you know, Nicky dressed as the devil. But I just, whenever they're on screen together, I just loved it so much. It's melodrama. It's, you know, kind of riffing on different genres. We get quite, especially with Dick, he's quite noirish, isn't he?
Yeah, he can
be. We get the kind of bumbling aspect with Andy in that. But they were brilliant together, and I would happily watch a show based on those two characters.
Yeah, I mean, Mike did mention this David Lynch show called On the Air, and I watched one episode of it, and it wasn't very funny. However, it was kind of cool to see, you know, there was Miguel Ferrer and the guy that plays Dick, so that was kind of fun, but the actual writing wasn't that funny, but it was kind of fun to see him. kind of thing. I just like the whole. I'm with you. I like the whole interaction, and I actually kind of. I remember laughing out loud when the thought bubble come up with little Nicky in a devil costume. It did make me laugh. I'm quite happy with that scene. I have no problems with it. Let's get on to a few of the bad guys, right? Leo. Yeah, no, he wasn't a great actor, but he did okay. I felt a bit bad for him because he went from like being a wife beater to like Frankenstein's monster, pretty much. Right?
Not even that, Frankenstein's bitch.
Yeah, he was more like Igor.
Yeah,
it's a cross between the monster and Igor, really. He was, and he was getting beaten up by Windermere. We'll talk about it in a bit. Yeah, Leo. There was one scene in particular where he kind of turned into Jason when he was attacking Shelley in the house, where he come back to life from like being in a sort of vegetative state. I really liked, actually. I like that scene. So
that was, I think, one of the scariest kind of moments of the show in terms of tension. Because we haven't quite really talked about the horror within the series too much, no. But that scene I thought was quite tense, and it very much for me was a kind of little homage to the slasher genre in particular.
Yeah, I agree. It was a good element, and probably the only bit of the show. I mean, most of the horror came about from stuff with Bob, really, the intense stuff, right? But this was about the only scene which wasn't involving Bob where it was horrific, so it's pretty cool. But that brings us on to Shelley. Should have talked about Shelley earlier than this, really. Mad Shenamic, she's in the season 3. I have to say, some of the stuff with Shelley was really good too. Stuff with Norma in particular, really enjoyed that. What do you think of Shelley?
Queen of Hearts.
Yes.
she's beautiful anyway, for starters. And I think she had some, her kind of story arc, and we touched on this again in Twin Peaks Log, that, you know, really great characters kind of had a bit of a lull in terms of how active they were, or in terms of, you know, their kind of story arcs. And unfortunately she did. But, I think, like you say, the scenes with Norma in particular were really stand out, and you know, their relationships as two women struggling within these, you know, really bad relationships, and having other men on the sides as well, that kind of mirror image. And Norma's quite a bit of a mother figure to her, and the way that, you know, story developed was lovely. But I really did like the scenes with Gordon Cole.
Yeah, they were fantastic. They were really, really cool, really enjoyable. I also have to say, I kind of like the fact with Shelley, we know that Bob is a div, right? whereas Norma's got Ed as her partner side, and Ed's like very solid, right? Bobby's a like goofball that makes all the promises and getting nowhere. So she's gone from Leo to Bobby, kind of, but that is not a good trajectory. But she doesn't care because she's like completely in lust with Bobby, it feels like, and I really kind of like that that vibe. I thought that was interesting sort of character motivation. Like she, but eventually she gets tired of him, right? She gets tired of his like little promises to do this and that and the other. It kind of gets a bit mad. I also have to say, there's a really good scene with Shelley when she's visiting Leo in the hospital with Doc Hayward. And Doc Hayward's telling her about Leo, and she kind of has to react. It's a very quiet scene, but I really liked it. I thought she did a really good job in that scene too.
Yeah.
There's a couple of minor characters I just mentioned in passing, which is Bernard Renault, who basically turns up to die, doesn't he? In fact, Leo kills him, and like no one says a word about it. Particularly his revenge. His brother Jean Reno turns up to create havoc and revenge for the death of his brother Jacques, but Bernard just gets forgotten. And the other one I was going to mention is Jacques Reno, who apparently is listed in only 3 episodes, but I'm sure it was in more than that. That's weird. Jacques Reno, pretty good. He was a right scumbag, pretty much, wasn't he? And particularly in Fire Walk with Me. Really horrible.
Yeah.
All right, let's skip over that one. We still got quite a few major characters to get through. Bobby, yeah, I've kind of mentioned him. I really like his acting performance, though he is very stylized in the first few episodes. Really like Bobby. One of the greatest scenes, in my opinion, is the scene between Bobby and his dad, where his dad tells him about the dream he had about Bobby. And, you know, I'm almost skipping over his dad. Don Davis as Garland Briggs, Major Garland Briggs' dad. Fantastic. Known in another major role, which is Scully's dad from The X-Files, right? Even though he was only in a few episodes of that, he's kind of really stood out. And he's great as Garland Briggs. That way he talks, man, it's properly otherworldly, and like real life people don't ever talk like that. But man, this guy delivers. Any comments?
The measured way he delivers, like you say, is just fantastic. And he, I've said this before, he reminds me a lot of, he kind of channels Cooper's otherworldly nature, and they seem like two kind of peas in a pod.
Yeah.
But he's lyrical as well. And, you know, the monologues that he delivers are just fantastic. I can watch him and his scenes over and over again.
Yeah, don't you wish he was president or something? You definitely trust.
I wish anybody else would be president.
Okay, and the other one of the Briggs family is Betty Briggs, who's in a few scenes, right? And she's okay. I like this one scene, they're going to church, she's wearing a big smiley face on a badge on her jumper on the way to church. That always makes me laugh. And she's all right. She isn't given much to do, though, is she, really? Which is kind of a shame. But she's pretty good in that role. In fact, there's a really weird deleted scene from Firewalk With Me in the section called The Missing Pieces, where there's a scene where she's sitting knitting or something, and Major Briggs is reading the Book of Revelation to her like a bedtime story almost. That makes me laugh. We've got some other mentions. Log Lady. I'm bringing the Log Lady at this point. The reason I'm bringing her in at this point is I think there's something about the triangle of Garland Briggs, Cooper, and the Log Lady. There's something about those three that have got similar. They're similar in their nature, in that they're not like, I don't know, normal ain't the right word. There's something otherworldly about all three of them.
Yes.
And I find that really interesting. And how they, when they interact with each other, because they're all slightly different and slightly odd, it's kind of, it adds some real interesting things with no obvious reason why it's interesting. It's just their performance and what they're saying to each other. I think there's one scene where the Log Lady says, "Are you proud?" She's looking at Major Briggs's medals, and she said something like, "Are you proud?" And he says, "No, virtue is its own reward," or something like that. But this is the kind of stuff we get, and it's kind of cool, right?
Yeah.
I do like the Log Lady, and she's kind of a tragic figure. I think she may be significant in season three too, but I'm not sure how. I just get that vibe. I'm not actually saying that. I don't know if she's on the cast list. I think she is, but I'm not entirely sure. I think a person I've already mentioned is Bobby's friend Mike, who's like, first he's Bobby's friend and doesn't actually do much, but then he's like Nadine's kind of obsession. And for a lot of the series, we're not sure if Nadine's just being a fantasist about Mike and he's not complicit at all. Because he actually tries to brush her off a few times, doesn't he? We kind of see that. But then he kind of gets into it. And I think he says to Bobby, "Have you any idea what, I don't know, something like super strength and experience can do, you know?" I don't know, it's something sleazy. it's a funny scene. So there's him. Jacoby. Yeah, he starts off being weird and suspicious, and you think, is he the murderer? But then he gets beaten up by some bloke who could be the murderer, so you kind of feel bad for him, and he has a heart attack, doesn't he? In fact, he's laid out with a heart attack recovery when Jacques Renault gets suffocated. What do you think of Jacoby?
I think Jacoby's a really interesting character, and it's a shame he kind of takes a bit of a back seat towards the end as other kind of, you know, character stories come to the fore. But, you know, during the initial kind of Laura Palmer investigation, we see a really kind of seedy side to him. And I don't think he's kind of harmful in any way, but he's just a kind of icky, really sad character.
It's kind of almost an emotional... Not vampire's too strong, but he kind of wants to live vicariously for others' experiences, almost. But certainly with Laura. But he does go on about how Laura made him interested in sort of viewing people in a different way again, because he was kind of tired of people and thought people were horrible. Doesn't he say at one point to Cooper, I want to be a nice person, but I'm not. I know I'm not. But Laura kind of changed that for me, which I thought was kind of sweet. Actually, but he does feel like he's a bit of a groomer for some of the series, doesn't he?
Manipulative,
yeah.
We see in the film, If I Walk With Me, that Laura really is quite disdainful towards him, yet in the tapes that he has, she sounds very cheery and such. Maybe it's drugs, maybe yeah. She's getting prescription drugs from him, and that's why she does it,
yeah.
But that bit didn't quite tie up for me. Their relationship seemed to have changed between the two.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on to the FBI. Right, so we've already talked about Cooper, obviously. Golden Carl we kind of mentioned, right? David Lynch, apparently he's reprising his role as Golden Carl in season 3. And I've got a feeling the actual show might revolve around Golden Carl rather than, say, Cooper. I got a feeling about that, and it's kind of hints that he might be significant. The only hints they've really given about the season 3 is it's going to relate quite a lot more to Far Walk With Me than Twin Peaks, the TV show, as much. So that kind of suggests to me Golden Cove's going to be kind of playing a major part. It's funny, isn't it? It's a funny vibe, him shouting everything. what do you think?
I love it. His character is kind of perfectly suited, and I love his relationship with Cooper. You know, that wonderful line he delivers, which is
make your smile an umbrella.
Yeah,
he's got all of those little homilies, isn't he? He's got a few of those.
He's just a very kind of confident character, and in a way, he's very much to me like Skinner in the X-Files. In that he has that kind of knowledge and he has that kind of confidence, and he doesn't give everything away. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but he's happy to talk, right? He's happy to give advice and stuff. It's fine. And he's happy to explain himself as well, and very loudly. which brings me to possibly my personal favourite character, Albert.
Yeah,
Miguel Ferrer. Unfortunately, sadly, he's died recently, but has shot all of his scenes for season 3 and will be in season 3. I'm glad to say. Love Albert. I think his first 5 or 6 scenes are all fantastic, in my opinion. I'm going to guess you agree from what we talked about before. Anything to say about Albert?
Just to say, you know, what a performance. You know, the writing alone, but, you know, the way that it's delivered was just fantastic. And again, the way that these characters interact with, you know, the rest of the kind of Twin Peaks crew is just fantastic. And it's such a shame. But I'm glad that he was able to wrap his scenes for the third series.
I'll tell you what, I just feel the need to cut in here Albert's a famous speech. Let's have a listen.
I'll be at the lab, gentlemen.
Anything we should be working on?
Yeah, you might practice walking without dragging your knuckles on the floor.
Albert, let's talk about knuckles. For the last time, I knocked you down. I felt bad about it. The next time is going to be a real pleasure.
You listen to me. While I will admit to a certain cynicism, the fact is that I'm a naysayer and hatchet man in the fight against violence. I pride myself in taking a punch, and I'll gladly take another because I choose to live my life in the company of Gandhi and King. My concerns are global. I reject absolutely revenge, aggression, and retaliation. The foundation of such a method is love. I love you, Sheriff Truman.
Albert's path is a strange and difficult one.
Okay, so we get the awesome of Albert there, right? I have to say, another one that always makes me laugh is a little story about when they turn up at Laura Palmer's autopsy and Albert wants to do it and he's got a drill. Apparently, when they were filming that, old Miguel Ferrer kept like revving up the drill and grinning at him and cracking everyone up. That's amazing. That just makes me laugh. Whole thing about that is awesome. Right, we're not... So these aren't all the FBI characters. There's one other significant one, which is David Duchovny as Dennis or Denise Bryson. Wow. That is turning up and stealing scenes, right? That's the way to do it. It takes a lot to steal a scene off of Kyle MacLachlan. I really love him as Denise. He is in season 3 as well. What's your thoughts?
I think he makes a better woman than I do.
Don't say that. I do laugh that Audrey actually, when Audrey meets him or her, she says, they have female agents in the FBI.
Yeah, no, he's brilliant. And I did cheer quite a bit when he came into the room. I thought it was a brilliant introduction as well. The way that he's introduced as, you know, Dennis and... Cooper saying to everybody, he's great, you know, one of the best. Then he walks in as Denise. So that was really brilliant.
I think that, you know, the people that come to Twin Peaks later than when it was first aired, but know the X-Files, their biggest shock when they watch Twin Peaks is when Heath rocks up. Because it isn't, like, widely discussed, is it, really?
No.
He just rocks up and it's like, you see him in the credits and then, bam, there he is, dressed as a woman. It's like, whoa. I'm going to pick up the pace a bit here because I didn't intend this to go on this long. Right, some of the bad guys. I mean, let's talk about the people from another place. We've got Bob. We've got Mike. We've got the Giant. We've got Mrs. Tremond and her grandson. We got these odd characters. Bob, very frightening character, right?
Yeah. And played brilliantly as well, I think.
Very bestial, right?
Yes.
Frank Silver did a great job there. He's unfortunately died. We're not going to get Bob looking like this in season 3. We may get something like Bob. We may get Bob with a different face. But yes, this was a really good turn. Bob is scary as shit. That scene when Madeline sees Bob crawling over the furniture is like, oh my God. You wouldn't fancy that, would you?
Not at all.
we get Philip Gerard, the man with one arm. I think this actor's really good in this role. I really like him when he goes into like his Shakespearean voice mode. As Mike, Bob's previous accomplice. I really, really dig this guy. What's your thoughts?
Yeah, you know, another great example of that, you know, kind of dualism in terms of the acting, and just all around, even when he's kind of the shoe salesman, I find him really intriguing, and I was a bit suspicious of him as a suspect in the initial kind of investigation, but he's quite noirish, I think.
Yes, he is, yeah. And he kind of reminds you of, like, The Fugitive, right? The one I'm... And then we get the more unusual characters that may be from the Red Room or the Black Lodge or the White Lodge. We don't really know. That's one of the wonders of Twin Peaks. We get the Giant and his potentially associated human form, which is the doddery old room service guy. He always makes me laugh whenever I see him. He turns up in a couple of major scenes as well, doesn't he? And The Man from Another Place, known more commonly as like the dancing dwarf, really. And we saw that, see that parody on Simpsons and all sorts, right? That scene the end of episode 3 is just amazing, right? Mind-blowing scene. People were talking about that for ages. And that really put Twin Peaks on the map in terms of being an absolute phenomenon. I nearly couldn't say it then. Phenomenon. And then we also get ones that we don't realise who they are until, like, you've learnt more about Twin Peaks, which is Mrs. Tremond and her grandson, who's played by David Lynch's son, right? In the TV show. And we've got them too. They kind of turn up in a room with the other characters in Fire Walk With Me. So that's how we get that association. Let's talk about some more of the bad guys. So we got Jean Reno, Michael Parks as Jean Reno. Again, sadly departed recently. I like his Jean Reno. I think he's really cool, actually. He's a very cool bad guy that was sadly cast to one side, you know, in a fit of... He could have spun out as a bad guy much longer, actually. But it was only in 5 episodes, but his presence feels like more to me. What about you?
Yeah, definitely. I really loved his performance there.
Very striking. Really liked him. Bizarrely, he always reminds me of a British singer from years ago called Max Bygraves. He just looks a bit like him. And it's Google it, you'll see what I mean. That's not going to mean anything to an American audience. But anyway, I think it was really good, really good. Quite threatening. More so than perhaps on Windham Earl, who became the next big bad guy in the series, right? After
Windham Earl.
Windham Earl. Now, we kind of like him and we laughed at him and we've kind of described him as a 60s Batman villain. And he's got these ridiculous disguises, which Mike Chinstroker described as Hannibal Smith disguises from the A-Team. They're a bit like that. I mean, he literally does turn up at one point as a pantomime horse. That's true, isn't it, Becky? I'm not lying.
That's very true, yes.
But some of his disguises were terrible, and we weren't even sure if they were disguises. We thought, is he supposed to be disguised as a fisherman, or is he going fishing for the day? It was like that, we couldn't tell. What do you think of Kenneth Welsh?
I enjoyed it, and like you say, I think when you described his performance as kind of 60s Joker-ish, you know, that kind of level, then that makes sense to me. But he just needed something more, like you mentioned about Michael Parks, you know, role as a villain. He needed something that made him a little bit more aggressive, a little bit more threatening, maybe more insidious, and we don't have that at all.
It's a shame. He did do it in spot. There was flashes of it, wasn't there, here and there, but he wasn't directed that way. It didn't seem... he should have been, to me, more Hannibal Lecter than, I don't know, Hannibal Smith, right? What is it from the 18? Is it Hannibal's? I can't remember. It's Hannibal Summit. So it was a bit unfortunate. And he was kind of badly used as well at the end. And of course, so his motivations kept changing, didn't it? First it was revenge, then it was seeking this and that. There was one scene I really liked with him where he was like in a close circuit TV and it was like old video of him talking about the Dugpus and the Black Lodge. And I thought that was really effective, actually. That kind of worked well for me in the way it was set up. Right, we're coming towards the end now. We got the Milford brothers, the mayor and Dougie Milford and Lana Milford. Lana, the sex witch, right? I like Lana. That's all I'm going to say about that. Got anything to say about that whole thing, the brothers or the old mayor or anything?
Comical. Again, it was kind of superfluous, I think, to the series overall, but it's Twin Peaks, isn't it?
Yeah. There was one character who turned up in the finale that kind of made me laugh, which was Del Mibler, the ancient bank president. David Lynch loves old blokes walking around really slowly and being hesitant, doesn't he?
He does indeed.
Yeah, so there's a bit of that. Let's just end on one other character that kept turning up, which was I think it was the same. I couldn't tell if it was the same character or the same actor doing different roles, which was Pinkle. Because he turns up first as the salesman for Leo's crane to get him out of bed when he was vegetative state and accidentally gets stuck in the crane while it's being hit against the wall. Then he turns up at the pine weasel thing with Dick talking about pine weasels. And then he's the choreographer of Miss Twin Peaks. And he
was he also the lawyer that spoke to Norma?
No, I don't think so. No, okay. I don't think that was him. But his choreography was amazing because he was getting him to like basically bump and grind, and it was like a beauty pageant. I was like, whoa. And he goes, "What?" I think Lucy says, "What kind of dance is this?" And he goes, "A nature dance." I was like, "Whoa." So there was that kind of stuff. The only other thing I haven't really mentioned is the Evelyn stuff. There's Evelyn and Malcolm and what was his name? What was her husband's name? I can't remember. Evelyn Marsh and her husband, who seemed like a very nice chap, but drove down the drive and his car exploded or something. And it was like, that was probably one of the weaker arcs. Right,
definitely.
I'm not sure. I think MT Wentz was the absolute worst arc, but this one ran for a fair bit longer and took a bit more screen time. Though I kind of liked what they were going for. It didn't quite work, and that was kind of a bit James's hitting his head against the post acting. That kind of didn't work for me. Right, so we've been for a whole set of characters. Right. If you're still with us now, anything else to say about the series?
What, overall?
Yeah.
Just to say that I think there are some absolutely standout episodes, but in every single episode, and this is a point you've made, that there are, you know, standout moments that make it worthwhile.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the reason I think why it's so, you know, so kind of high up on our, you know, best television lists, you know, of all time.
Do you see yourself watching it again and again?
Yeah, definitely.
Well, I do, so answer that one. Okay, I'll tell you what, let's have a little musical break and then we'll pick up some feedback we got off of the United Nations of Horror. Okay, so we asked for some feedback from the United Nations of Horror on this, so I'm just going to go through this in order. Michael Harvey says, I watched Twin Peaks during its original run. Me too. I never missed an episode despite my utter bewilderment as to what was going on. However, I remember being incredibly frustrated, brackets, or rather angry, at the final episode's conclusion. I've never seen the series since, and although I'm curious about its return, I'm not sure if it's something I want to return to. Angry? Yeah, I can kind of see why you'd be angry. What about you, Becky? Could you see why I'd be angry?
kind of. But again, I'm quite lucky in that I came to it knowing that I would have hopefully some answers quite soon. I would hope he would give it another go.
Yeah. Well, I wonder what he was frustrated at. Was it the fact there were so many cliffhangers, or is it the whole Cooper thing? I'm going to guess it's the Cooper thing because that's the emotional investment. Though, you know, Audrey blowing up was a deal. Ben possibly dying to deal, I guess. But I guess what everyone really remembers is Cooper in the mirror, right?
Yeah.
So we're going to assume that is that Michael, all right? Okay. Then Talicia posted, she's posted a picture of a cup of coffee and a donut, I think, on her desk. And she says, didn't get breakfast in time before work this morning, and now I've had to grab a donut and a coffee from our lounge. So I'll be channeling Agent Cooper and Sheriff Truman this AM. Nice one, Talicia. Dan Pollitt's posted a YouTube link of MC Chris doing, I think, a song about Twin Peaks. I didn't listen to this, actually.
You need to listen to it. It was hilarious.
All right, well, that's advice. Google Twin Peaks MC Chris and you can see what that's all about. And I will go and listen to it straight after this recording. I promise. Erin... Miss Gould has written in and said, I wrote something a few weeks ago about how Laura Palmer manages to cram everything she does into one day. I'm convinced she's part Time Lord. Oh, man, don't even bring Time Lords into this thing, honestly. I'll tell you what, if you start reading the secret history of Twin Peaks, there's so much other stuff in there. I wouldn't be surprised if there's Time Lord stuff. That being said, the character James, why did Lynch keep trying to make him a thing? Like, I get the appeal of James Dean, but James Dean, he was not. If you're going to do something, do it properly or not at all. Ah, poor old James, real horrible. I have a good feeling about this character and this actor in season three, mainly because David Lynch is directing, and I think James works when David Lynch directs him. So I'm hopeful that James will actually turn out to be something wonderful. But we'll see, right? We'll see. Got any more comments on James, or do you think we've shit on him enough?
Well, I find him kind of endearing as well, I think.
Yeah, he's puppyish, right?
He is, and we've mentioned before that, you know, he's quite, in terms of, you know, a character archetype, he's basically good, you know, he's all goodness and light in the series. And I think that's really interesting in terms of the you know, the themes of, you know, evil, good, all that sort of stuff.
Oh, and then we're getting into a riff here along this thing with Talicia and Erin throwing out things, right? So Talicia says, James was a fertile source of MST3K-style riffing for my boyfriend and me. His acting range pretty much consisted of just throwing his bow when emotion was called for. Yeah, fair enough. Erin then comes back with, how did that direction go? Okay, pout. No, poutier. No, poutier. Just look like I just stole your ice cream cone. Puff those lips. Look downwards. Pout, damn you. Yeah, I can see that. Talicia then says, cut to the actor with a pained look, trying to show emotion. Must show emotion. Yeah, there was definitely a bit of that. Erin, I think in some shots you can see steam coming out of his ears. It was not up to the task. Yeah, it was a bit of a shame. I think he was somewhat misused. I don't know. I can't keep blaming him. Talicia then said, what you want to bet that's actually why he broke that pencil in the scene with the teacher announcing Nora's death? he did, didn't he, in the pilot? Erin, it's too bad we can't flash Emmy clip underneath some scenes. Wow. Okay. And then Dan Pollitt finally chimes in. He was one of the 1990s premier acting droids, along with Keanu Reeves before the software update, and David Duchovny. No!
Oh, no, I don't agree with that, Dan. I'm sorry. Even Keanu Reeves. I think Keanu Reeves is really, when he's
in the
role. Yeah, definitely.
Well, Bill and Ted, really. No, I think he was good in Speed as well. And I like him in John Wick. But yeah, I get Keanu Reeves, yeah. Michael Harvey made the point, in terms of a show posing lots of questions and answering few, Twin Peaks was a precursor to Lost. I'm pretty sure...
Great point.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure we wouldn't have Lost if Twin Peaks hadn't... If we hadn't have had Twin Peaks, so yeah, that seems fine. Then Tim Hutton chimed in. Everyone bags on James Marshall and his performance. Okay, I'm going to have a pause here because yeah, I want people to wonder what he's going to say. But for me, nothing can eclipse Lenny von Dolan's nails on a chalkboard performance as Harold. He's even more one note than James, with a range that goes from whiny to whiny stalker. I get that he was probably introduced as a bit of a red herring, but the way he was written and performed just grates on my nerves. There's more. There's the absolute lowest point is to be the bit where he dragged garden tool across his face and reached Tommy Wiseau levels of emoting. Ugh. So Tim's not entirely a fan of Harold.
Are you sure?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that. Fair enough. I'm not going to argue with that. Would you want to tell Tim he's wrong, Baggy, or what?
No, we've already agreed that he's, you know, a bit one note. I don't think he's as bad potentially as Tim, you know, obviously feels. But I can see totally why he does feel that way.
So next bit of feedback, Bern. Oh, sorry, I'm going to butcher your name. Sorry, old fella. But here we go. Brund Breidenbrick. Sorry. Can't say enough. Until I've seen the whole show, I won't believe that this time David Lynch will tell us all the secrets of Twin Peaks. No, there's no way he's going to tell us all. I'm telling you now, I know that. It's going to end on cliffhangers, if anything. I've seen all his movies after Twin Peaks and parts of Inland Empire, but he never told us why in the end. Read the three books too, the diaries, very often. The only thing I noticed was the diary of Laura Palmer had some parts that crashed with Twin Peaks movie, and the mystery of Lynch's movies can be compared to the classic mystery shows like The Prisoner and Lost. Yeah, I often think of The Prisoner, actually, when I'm thinking Twin Peaks. Have you seen The Prisoner, Becky?
No.
Okay, it's an interesting one. It's one of my favourite TV shows, but it's kind of a bit... cryptic.
Yeah. Fast forward a few months and we're doing a series on The Prisoner.
Be doing that. April Cox Hinderleiter says, am I the only one that didn't care for Fire Walk With Me? I thought it incongruent with the series. I think it is incongruent with the series, and I kind of get people you didn't like it, and I have problems with parts of it. If you go listen to our show and follow with me, I have quite distinct problems with a middle section. What do you think?
If you have 10 hours, go and listen to our show and follow up with me.
Oh yeah, it's a 4-hour 20 minute show. We did not mess about that one. So Tim, picking up from what April said, Tim Adams says, April, I didn't think much of it when I first saw it in 93, like you. I felt it was too different from the series I loved. I personally had real problems with the Gordon Cole section, personally, just to sort of briefly say here. And I had a problem with the first lot in the first set of scenes, which go on for a fair length, even though kind of fun, because personally, whenever I watch it, I'm waiting to see Twin Peaks, the town of Twin Peaks, so I have this problem. You don't have this problem, Becky, right?
No, I really enjoyed the,
you like the film.
The first kind of, we said it was kind of like in three parts, didn't we? So yeah. The first kind of two parts before you get to Twin Peaks, I really enjoyed.
Yeah. Tim goes on to say, I hadn't seen it again until a few weeks ago, and I watched immediately after binging the entire series. On this second watch, I found it much more compelling and a natural fit for the darker, mysterious elements of the series. I recommend giving it a rewatch if you're planning on taking in season 3. Absolutely. It's apparently key to season 3. And I think he what Tim said there is the perfect way to watch Fire Walk With Me, which is straight after finishing season 1 and season 2. I would never recommend watching this as prequel before watching the TV show. It just doesn't work that way, in my opinion. What's your thoughts?
Yeah, I don't think you can. I think it's completely geared for, you know, fans of the the TV show.
And I don't think it works as a standalone film. If you didn't know about Twin Peaks, it just wouldn't work for you. So, you know, it's a very, very distinctive film in that sense. It's like you need to have watched this before you watch this.
It's a chapter, isn't it, in the overall kind of story.
Indeed. It's funny how Twin Peaks spans so many different media. It's got, you know, all working together to tell a bigger story, right? There's The Secret Diary and The Secret History and various other things. There's even audio diaries of Cooper and, you know, stuff like that. April then says, I'm looking forward to season three, but it concerns me that it will take more After Firewalk with me. I don't mind it being dark, but bring back the mystery. I don't think there was a short of mystery, personally.
I think I may be wrong, but I think she kind of feels that the film, like I was saying, you know, stripped away the kind of mystery and that kind of almost, you know, mythology kind of aspect of how Laura Palmer was presented, and that we weren't quite sure what was going on. You know, we didn't see her necessarily as a person. She was just this huge kind of idea, this entity that was propelling all of these events.
And then to see the
nitty gritty. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think maybe she's thinking along those lines like I was.
Yeah. And also it's a harsher and more direct, it's a spotlight right on the thing, isn't it? Whereas the series is like a vague light and skirt stuff, you know, and goes on about other things. In the TV series, Laura Palmer was kind of the elephant in the room no one wants to talk about.
Yes.
I see what April's saying there. I think. Okay, that ends this show. We've gone through the feedback too. So it's been fun. I mean, come and listen to us on the Twin Peaks log if you're a fan of Twin Peaks. We're always after new listeners. You can kind of... we're not quite sure how we're going to tackle season three, but we won't... We're obviously probably one episode a week or something like that. It depends, right? We'll probably end up just watching whatever's available immediately and trying to figure out how to do a show around it. Who knows? In the UK, it's here on the it's on the day after you get it in America, so there'll be a slight delay, but we'll probably be doing it kind of weekly as best we can, right? Okay, so in terms of UNH, I'm not sure what we got lined up next. We've got a few plans on the UNH roster, haven't we? At some point, we're going to need to get back to Supernatural, and we got a few others in store. But we'll figure out something, and there'll be something from UNH real soon. I've forgotten the spiel for all the, you know, giving us feedback. Go to www.UnitedNationsOfHorror.com. Sorry, it's not the, is it? It's www.UnitedNationsOfHorror.com, and have a look on there for any sort of contacts, feedback. Send in written feedback or MP3s. That'd be very cool. Time to say bye, right, Becky?
Yes.
So bye from me.
Bye from me.
And until next time on the United Nations of Horror.
She's dead, wrapped in plastic. Damn good coffee and hot. Black as midnight on a moonless night.
Do your palms ever itch? One day, my log will have something to say about this.
It is happening again. It is happening again.